This is An Hour with Oscar Peterson, produced by WNYC New York in honor of Peterson's 75th birthday. What kind of a music student were you?
I was obsessed with trying to gain a foothold into an area of comfort, executionally speaking. I'd start to play things and there'd be things that I'd run up into a blank wall. And I didn't want the technical aspect of the instrument to interfere with what I was thinking conceptually.
Was there a moment where you said, I've crossed the line, I'm there, you know, I've got the technique and now I can really soar?
That still hasn't come. In my mind, I still have things that I would like to do.
Oscar Peterson was born in Montreal in 1925. Since having been introduced to American audiences at a famous Jazz at the Philharmonic concert in 1949, his career has taken him everywhere in the world. He has played alone and with literally every one of his great jazz contemporaries. I'm Sarah Fischko, and for the next hour, a conversation with music featuring the pianist's pianist, Oscar Peterson. Well, first of all, I wanted to talk a little bit about the whole classical jazz issue, because it's not all that usual to start the way you started and come to where you've come, in the sense of you're having had this kind of rigorous classical training and then gone over to the jazz side. I wonder...
Well, actually, Sarah, it isn't unusual, or it wasn't unusual, certainly in my coming up days. Because when you have to start an instrument, you usually start it with some kind of assistance with how you're going to handle it technically and harmonically and emotionally. You can't do this too easily on your own. And when I was coming up, the natural procedure was to go to the classics. And I think perhaps that's one of the things we miss in some of the pianists today.
But you really had rigorous, serious classical training.
Yes, I did. I studied with my older sister, Daisy, who was a classical teacher. And she then farmed me out to a wonderful classical pianist by the name of Paul DeMarchi. And he and I became not only teacher and pupil, but friends. He was a jazz addict. He loved jazz also, which is unusual in those days for a classical performer, because jazz wasn't as prevalent in the classical world as it is today.
Is he the one who introduced you to jazz, or had you
heard jazz? No. I came from a relatively large family, and my older brother Fred was the first one that was curious about jazz, and I used to hear him playing these tunes that I knew nothing about. It had nothing to do with what I was starting out with. Turned out he was playing jazz tunes. What were then jazz tunes? And it interested me in the fact that he was trying to play along the tune, apart from just playing the tune. That part of it interested me very, very much. And that's where I started becoming interested in improvisation.
Peterson's early improvisation on Dvorak's Humoresque, 1945.
Fred, who died at 16, was a much better pianist than I ever will be.
Really?
Yeah. I think so. My sisters dispute this, but they don't know what they're talking about. I always say if he was alive today, I would be his manager. No, really, he was that good.
Is it true you got to the piano via the trumpet?
Yeah. Via the trumpet, via tuberculosis. And when I came out of the hospital, the doctor said, no more trumpet in those days. Said, no, that's not good for his lungs. You know, he's already had TB. Go back to the piano. So I did.
I'm glad you did.
I don't think I ever would have left it anyway.
Amazing that all of you really got the gift.
Yeah, it was a musical family. Well, you know, I think this part of the, it says something about our modus operandi today in family life, is that we weren't a well-off family. We weren't starving, but we weren't well-off. And so we made the most of family things. And my father and mother loved music, and we used to get together, and we'd sing hymns, and we'd sing different tunes, and we'd play. And I think that because of the inner interaction between the members of the family, we each caused the other to grow in various ways. My older sister, Daisy, went the classical way. And I was a renegade. I went the other way. I wouldn't practice in my earlier years. And I depended on my ear. That's the making of somebody that's going to be in jazz. You have to have an ear in jazz. So she'd put herself through the paces. My dad would leave work for us to do when he had these railway runs. He was a porter on the railway. He said, when I come back, you have this and that and that and that and that ready for me. And she'd diligently sit to that keyboard day after day working on these things. And I'd be up in baseball down the street. A couple of days before he got back, I'd sit on the stoop, and she'd be going through the whole thing of what we had to play. My dad would come home and hear each one of us. He said, Daisy, Fred, come here. How about playing the things I left you to do? And he had a book with all these things in it. And he'd make it or not make it, and then Daisy would come. He'd say, Oscar, and they'd all wait. You know, say, oh, here's where he gets his lumps. He hasn't touched the piano this week. But I had it up here. Or to the best of my ability, I had it up there. Enough to get past him.
So you squeaked by without doing the work?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
I had a memory then. I don't have it anymore.
But then at some point you got obsessed. And you practiced till your fingers nearly fell.
No, that was in the very early years. And then finally I came to my senses and realized that, you know, there's a little more to this than just sitting on the stoop.
And you must have known you were good, because then you left school and declared yourself a pianist.
I didn't know I was good, really. I just knew this is what I wanted to do.
The famous story of the discovery of Peterson's talent is almost too good to be true. As the story goes, Norman Granz was on his way to the Montreal airport in a taxi and heard a radio broadcast of great piano playing. Who's that? Said Granz. The cabbie said, that's Oscar Peterson, live at the Alberta Lounge. Granz said, turn around, let's go there. But you say you didn't know how good you were. So you mean when Norman Granz heard you in 49 and brought you to New York and all that?
Well, before he brought me to New York, we talked about it that night in the Alberta Lounge, and he said, I think you ought to come down and play my concert. I said, I don't think I'm ready for that. I had his records. I said, I know who you have on these things. I said, I can't play with these people. He said, how do you know? Have you ever played with them? So he talked me into it, and I said, okay. and went down to play at Carnegie Hall.
Must have been quite a moment.
Yeah, it was.
Not for a second, so we have a surprise for everybody.
So I sat there and shriveled up there in the first half while I listened to Roy and Coleman and Lester Young and Hank Jones and the rest of them. Finally, he came and got me. He said, okay.
From Canada, his first appearance in the United States, Oscar Peterson.
Pretty terrifying, huh?
It wasn't once I got started. Once I got out there with Ray, that was another situation I had to deal with, and that's all I was involved with. I was trying to cope with Ray Brown.
From Jazz at the Philharmonic, September 18th, 1949. Bass player Ray Brown and Peterson had a long association. There was one night in particular.
We were playing this night, and he had a thing going where I'd say if he played something on his bass that, solo-wise, that was really, you know, out there, a really good phrase, and I'd say, you better watch that. Pettifer just walked in the house. And I can't tell you what our usual retorts were, but anyway. And he'd go on and say, because he knew Pettifer wasn't there. And he'd say this about Tatum. He'd say to me, watch it. Archibald, I'd make a run or some kind of a musical idea. And he'd say, well, you better not do that. Tatum just walked in the house. And I'd give him the same retort he gave me the night before. Except that one night Ray has a funny way. When he becomes excited, I used to call him Maria Callas. His voice goes up to a soprano. You know, instead of saying, hey, hey, watch it, Tatum's in, it was, hey, no, I'm not kidding, he's in here. One of those things. You know, so. And then I looked around, and there he was.
He was your idol, Art Tatum. I know what happened when you first heard Tiger Rag.
I mean, when I still hear Tiger Rag. it was shocking. I can't say it frightened me, it just stunned me.
Tatum, Tiger Rag, 1932.
Forget the command of the instrument. That's the thing that has always bugged me about the evaluation of Art Tatum. Everyone used to say, man, boy, can he play the way he'd run up and down that piano? That means nothing. I don't mean it means nothing, but that isn't that hard to do. But it was the harmonic intent that he had going, the places that he would take these tunes harmonically, the intricate little filigree things that he had going between his hands as he played. I sat there different times right off of his elbow watching him do this, and you had to realize this is a man that could not see the keys, could not see what his hands were doing. These incredible counterpoint things, you know, that classical pianists spend probably years getting a hold of. And he'd just run these things off, you know, he'd stop and wipe his brow with one hand and be playing and continue the piece with the other one. I learned that trick from him.
It must have been amazing to meet him.
It was incredible. He's just, the funny thing, Art Tatum and I struck up a friendship. A very warm friendship. One of those friendships with very few words in them. And I was playing in a club in L.A., and we were playing, I forget the tune we were playing, but I remember now that I had a pretty good handle on the tune that night, and I heard this voice from the audience, different things I'd played, I heard this voice saying, "Oh, wow, stop it, Oscar." And I didn't recognize the voice. Or, "I heard you, behave yourself," or something. I can't remember exactly what it turned out to be. Art, who had come into the club quietly, and he was sitting up against the wall. And this night he told me, he said, "You know, you've got it. Whatever it is, you've got it." He said, "And but it's my time right now. When I'm finished, you got it next."
So that was like a kind of a threshold you crossed in that moment?
Not necessarily, but because I didn't think that he was ready to give up anything. Not the way he thought and played, no. And there were too many other players that I admired and still admire in the jazz field. You know, in the jazz field, at least when I entered it in the United States, the piano was a very crowded field. There were more pianists around. You had Earl Garner, Teddy Wilson, Hank Jones, Barry Harris, Milt Buckner. My God, it was just unbelievable. Bill Evans came in later on, and there was a myriad of pianists just sitting around playing piano.
You've talked about the idea of playing pianistically.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by that?
Well, because you are playing a piano. It is a certain instrument. The instrument remains the same. The piano will never be a trumpet. It'll never be a saxophone. It'll never be a bass. It has all of these registers within it, but it doesn't have the impact from a sonic sense that a trumpet has, and it doesn't have the same type of string attack that a bass has being plucked as opposed to being hit with a hammer. And on and on, and the same thing as the breezy sound of a saxophone, you will not get out of a piano. So why not play it as what it is, as a piano? I can understand being influenced. I was influenced by Byrd and Diz and certainly Roy Eldridge and Coleman Hawkes and everything. And I've played phrases that they've played, but I've played them from a pianist's viewpoint. Piano demands, at the same time, they're playing singular lines, but the piano demands a left-hand accompaniment at the same time that enhances what the right hand is doing. And this is where Art Tatum never forgot. People like Art Tatum.
Because they were two-handed pianists.
Hank Jones didn't forget it. He was from that era. He didn't forget it. Earl Garner certainly didn't forget it. And it's something I've always tried to do with my teacher. Paul DeMarkey always said that. So never forget you're playing a piano. And the piano has many, 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 many voices and many moods. And you have to move in and out of these. And I realized he was right. As technically prolific as they claim I am, I have different times been called upon to play a simple melody for whatever reason. Behind a vocalist or because the tune is that simple. And it doesn't become a problem for me because I hear each note as I play it. And I try to hear the resonance of each note when I strike it so that the F doesn't sound exactly the same as the G or the F sharp or the B natural, depending on what the tune is that I'm playing. I think that some pianists perhaps overlook that. They forget that these notes each has its own resonance area, and they sing a different way in each of those areas. I've always said, you know, I can teach anybody to play fast. Anybody can learn to play fast, no big deal. If you play whatever the phrase is over and over and over again, sooner or later, you're going to play it. But the thing is to be able to intensify your ideas, put them into focus, not only for yourself, certainly, but for the listening audience.
Royal Festival Hall, 1978. Now, you've, you know, recorded so much, but there are a few kind of pinnacles of the of your recording that I'd love to talk about a little bit. I mean, I'd love to know for you, are they still pinnacles, like that Stratford recording, which you said, you know, that was the most comfortable you'd felt up to that point in the 50s? Is that still in your memory as a...
Yeah. Well, ironically enough, that took 2 nights to reach that comfort zone with the group, because actually we recorded the night before, and I wiped the whole thing. I said, no, this isn't it. We can't use it.
What do you think about that session was so... What happened there?
Hungry group. I think everybody came in hungry. And as a result of that, everybody wanted a part of that evening for their own, which is the way it should be. If you have great soloists in a group, that's the way it should be. And each one decided that when I get my shot, I'm taking it. And they did, as I tried to.
I guess when it all happens at the same time, it's kind of
That's
magical.
What it's nice.
Stratford, 1956, with Herb Ellis and Ray Brown.
The way a group becomes a musical competitive group within itself. It's because of that groups reach some of the, as you say, pinnacles that they reach. It's a competitive thing every night. Every single night. The first night that Barney Kessel came in my group, he wiped up the stage with me. Didn't do it the second night, though. It's the difference.
You were shocked, huh?
Yeah, I was shocked, and Ray Brown was instigating. You know, I got my rear end kicked, and Ray Brown couldn't get over it. He thought it was great. He said, you know, what are you going to do with this? You have to face this every night. I said, yeah, but you know something funny? I'll make him think about coming to work tomorrow night.
Thank you. I'm Sarah Fischko. In a moment, Oscar Peterson in the Black Forest and elsewhere. You're listening to An Hour with Oscar Peterson, presented on the occasion of his 75th birthday. Now, part two of An Hour with Oscar Peterson. I'm Sarah Fischko. In the 60s, a wealthy enthusiast invited Peterson to make a series of recordings under extraordinary circumstances.
You know what I want to hear about? I want to hear about that villa in, near the Black Forest. Where?
Oh, MPS.
That must have been some setup there.
It was in the home of Hans-Jörg Brunner Schreer, as you probably know. And he was, and he loved jazz, and he particularly loved piano, I think. And I think he became a fan of mine, and he went to Norman Granz and asked if we would consent to play at his house at a party that he had, that he wanted to have, and have me play. But he also wanted to record it for his own personal, you know, enjoyment. And Norman told him that he could do that. And he was so overjoyed with it, he said, "We've got to do this again. This is not enough. I can't live with just that. I just got to hear you play more and more and more." But we were so comfortable at his house. He and his wife were great hosts for us. And the people that came were totally attentive. No one moved, no one made noise, and it was exactly as the album said, especially for my friends. We were playing for a group of friends. And that was easy to do because it removed the cold stigma of a studio. And that's how that came about. We had a ball. It was really incredible.
Lulu's Back in Town, recorded at Brunner Schwer's Villa, 1968.
That's sort of a halfway salute to Fats Waller.
Thank you.
what'd you learn from Nat Cole, from listening to those, to that playing?
I learned the importance of controlling a group from the intensity or non-intensity of my playing. I learned an awful lot about lines, improvisational lines. I certainly was able to learn a lot about time, because Nat had impeccable time. And I learned a lot about phrasing. These were all natural attributes of his, though. He and I were distant, close friends. Because of what we were doing professionally, we seldom, unfortunately, got to see each other and be with each other as much as I think we both wanted to. But we had a great love for each other. I still have great love for him.
Is there a special tune he played in a special way you can think of that you remember specifically?
Easy Listening Blues. Because that is the true essence of blues piano, to my way of thinking.
The Nat King Cole Trio, 1944.
Did Easy Listening Blues.
As a salute only. There's only one original.
The Oscar Peterson Trio, 1973.
Said to me that improvising is like talking, in the sense that you know you have command of the language, and then you just, every time you say a sentence, it's an improvisation.
Well, that's the thing that I say about many critics. They don't understand this. You don't have to have a huge vocabulary to make yourself understood, but the more that you can use the important words, the better understood you will be. The sooner you can make your point. Because if you have that kind of command of the language, you're at ease. And it flows. You should gain this command of the instrument so that you can evaluate the upcoming idea while you're playing the one that is taking place, which you have to do in jazz. You have to think ahead.
How do you do that?
I've never been able to answer that question. I don't know. I just know that that's the way I operate, and that's the way I've seen many, many of my friends in the jazz world operate, and maybe that's why it makes jazz the entity that it is. Once I come up with a phrase within myself, it's already rehearsed inside of me, let's put it that way. I know where I'm going to place that phrase. The only thing that sometimes they don't understand, this is being done the odd time at breakneck speed. Four bars can go by like a freight train passing a hobo. I'm not thinking about this four bars. That's already been transmitted to my fingers. I'm thinking about what are we going to connect that with. And that's, I think, what's difficult for many people to understand about jazz. Especially when they hear the breakneck tempos that people like Dizzy and Art Tatum and yours truly and different people have played at. They just don't believe that you can play there without this all being pre-rehearsed thing. I'll play this here. If I get to that, I'll play that there. It doesn't work like that. I play along the minute. That's the way I play. Very human thing about jazz is that if I come across that tune, maybe later in the day, never mind tomorrow, my reaction may be totally different. That is exactly what has helped to make jazz, is that people are listening to the emotional reactions of these various players as they are confronted with these various tunes. And that's what you are listening to. You're listening to them saying, this is the way this tune affects me tonight, at this moment. If you wake me up tomorrow morning, I may play it totally different for you, for whatever reason.
Peterson has had a phenomenal number of collaborations in the course of his career. He credits one producer in particular with creating the atmosphere that made it possible.
Norman Granz, I guess we should just mention Norman Granz, who really kind of changed your life.
Well, you can't really just mention Norman Granz.
That's true.
He tends to take over the whole music scene the minute you call his name. And I say that lovingly. That's where I consider myself very lucky and very fortunate, because I had such wonderful teachers, my sister and Mr. DeMarkey, and in essence, Art Tatum, Nat Cole. And from a performance standpoint, there was Norman Granz, who was my greatest critic and still is. Ever since Norman Granz has been out of the recording business, the jazz recording business has failed miserably, if you think about it. The excitement of going to get an album of various people playing together and this and that does not exist anymore, to my way of thinking, the way it did. I know people used to wait to hear an album with Coleman Hawkins and Charlie Parker together and this and that and the other. Not today. They're not really that interested. They're off into something else. But Norman has stopped producing out those albums.
Don't tell him that.
I'm going to tell him as soon as I talk to him. I never thought of it until just now. He'd say, you know, this person sure can play. I wonder how they would react if I put so-and-so with them. He was a great musical instigator. He did it with me also. Mm-hmm. He'd say, that's how the Basie albums came about. He'd say, I think Basie wants a piece of you. And I loved and still do love and respect Basie to the point where I said, Norman, don't start anything. You know, he said, no, I'm serious. You know, I think Basie wants a piece of you. He thinks he can get you. That's the way he used to operate.
Oscar Peterson and Count Basie, 1978.
I've done so many with albums, it's hard to Well, it's something that I think it can only happen if you're really truthful in your playing. In other words, if I play against somebody, I used to do this with Ella. She loved to do that. But the only way you can truthfully do it is if you honestly listen to what they have just played. Don't sit there and say, I know the harmonic sequence that I'm going to be confronted with, and I think I'll play this during it. That isn't the way you do that. You play off of the other person. Ella should have been an instrumentalist. I shouldn't say that because it isn't right. Because we wouldn't have Ella as we know her. But I mean, she could have been. She would have had, could have easily had a double life. She could have been an instrumentalist. Par excellence. And she really enjoyed singing with people like Coleman Hawkins, Roy Eldridge. And at times she tried to emulate them.
Ella and Oscar, 1975.
The murmur of the morning breeze up there, the rattle of the milkman on the stair. Sugar, what there's music, mighty fine music. The singing of the sparrow in the sky, the perking of the coffee right nearby. There's my favorite melody. You, my angel, phoning me, 'cause I hear music, my honey, fine music. And anytime I think my world is wrong, I get me out of it and sing this song.
Do you ever want to leave the standards behind and just go someplace musically? Just
you mean go down a different road? Well, actually, it wouldn't be going down a different road because it's still harmonically and linearly the same thing. The only outlet to that is if I create my own superhighway, which I like some of the things I've written. I don't think I'm kind of composer that I would like one day like to be, so I couldn't base everything on that. I'm the type of person that I pride myself on this. If somebody said to me, write a tune for me right now, I could do it. I believe I could do it. But that doesn't mean that I'm happy with whatever I write totally by any means. I still go back and look at what I've done. And that's the beauty of writing. You can evaluate, go back and evaluate and say, I could have done that a little differently. You can't do that on stage. You can do it after a record date. After a record date? No. I don't even listen to my records many times. I seldom ever listen to my records. If I'm with somebody else and I want to hear them, I'll put it on that. You know, the funny thing, I think, unknowingly, I may have inherited this from Duke Ellington, who was never interested in what he'd done in the past. I did that several times. I asked him about a couple of tunes that he'd written. He was not interested. He always wanted to say, I got to figure out what I'm going to do tomorrow. That's kind of the way I feel about it.
What are you going to do for your birthday? It's a big one this year.
You mean because I'm going to be 75? Is that what you mean? Other than any health hazards, I don't consider it to be too different. as long as I can operate doing the things I would like to do. There's some things in life at this stage that I cannot do, but they can be supplanted with other things. So if I can deal with that, then I can deal with 75 years of age. Other than that, it doesn't interest me. Other people get very upset as they approach the latter part of that. I'm not upset. I'm not worried. I've been good. Well, I have. I haven't been locked up yet. I'm still here, right? I'm seriously, I have nothing to be regretful about, really. There have been some ups and downs in my life, as everyone. It's no different than anybody else. And I'm very happy that for the better part of my life, I've been a very fortunate and thankful person for what's happened to me. I've been honored. I've been defiled. But everybody has. That's not new. I can deal with that. I can deal with the defiling aspect. I can deal with the, certainly with the honoring. That's very nice. And so I get embarrassed sometimes, but
the comforting thing is they usually don't bother to defile people that they haven't honored so much.
Yeah.
Usually happens in that order.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Stravinsky had a Stravinsky had the line I like. I'm going to start using it. When he said, they asked him about his critics and purportedly said, I've yet to see a monument to a critic. I think it's a great line. I'll have to use that.
All right, Oscar Peterson. I thank you so much.
Well, thank you for visiting with me anyway.
You've been listening to An Hour with Oscar Peterson, produced at WNYC. Technical director for the program was Steve Nelson. Executive producer was Dean Capello. And special thanks goes to Fred Child. I was producer and host. I'm Sarah Fishko.